From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Josie Huang.
I'm Ann Mostu, and for Wednesday, March 10th, this is Maine Things Considered. Governor John Baldacci unveils a jobs bond package that is $20 million leaner than the one proposed by Democratic legislators.
A new report ranks Maine 8th in the country for getting federal aid based on its census numbers.
And a Mid-Coast theater group celebrates the work of one of Maine's best-known poets.
She grew up in Rockland. She went to high school in Camden and, of course, became the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for poetry.
Those stories are coming up, but first, this news.
And for MPBN News, I'm Frank Farrell. A bill to require health warnings on cell phones is going before the full legislature, but with no real support from the Health and Human Services Committee. The warnings would address the risk of brain cancer from excessive cell phone use. The cell phone industry says research fails to support the claims, so they oppose any warnings. The bill is also opposed by State Health Director Dr. Dora Mills.
And there's some very good published studies that do not show that there's not an increase even in people in their 20s and 30s over the last 10 or 20 years when cell phone use has increased.
No one on the Health and Human Services Committee actually supported the measure. Committee co-chair Joe Brannigan, a Democratic state senator from Portland, voted for it to assure that it would be debated by the full legislature. Four former officers of the largest union at Bath Ironworks are suing the machinist union for defamation and slander. Former local president Mike Keenan, chief steward Mike Sir, local trustee Kathy London, and vice president Troy Osgood were suspended by the parent union in March of 2008 after allegations surfaced of shoddy accounting, porn on union computers, and failure to deal with grievances properly. They contend in a complaint in Sagadahoc County Superior Court that the Machinist Union launched a campaign of false, malicious, and reckless allegations. Machinist Union spokesman John Carr says the union would defer comment until it has reviewed a copy of the 10-page complaint. And Maine Senator Susan Collins has asked Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to streamline federal approvals for offshore wind projects.
I don't want our country to lose the edge in the development of alternative energy, particularly offshore wind.
Salazar agreed that it was absolutely unacceptable, as he put it, that currently federal approvals can take 3 to 9 years. Collins said Maine is very excited about the possibility of leading the nation and the world in the development of deep water offshore wind power. And the Maine Labor Department says unemployment rose 0.1% in January to a rate of 8.2%. Commissioner Laura Fortman says there are just under 58,000 unemployed people in Maine, which is 6,500 more than a year ago. About three-fourths of the job losses have occurred in the construction, manufacturing, and retail sectors. The only sectors with job gains, says Fortman, were education and health services and leisure and hospitality. Three Maine women are among about 200 female pilots being honored today at a Washington, D.C. ceremony for their services in World War II. Edith Beale of Bridgeton, Betty Brown of Skowhegan, and Phyllis Paradis of Bass Harbor all flew non-combat missions within the U.S. as members of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or the WASPs. Established in 1942, they were part of the war effort. Congress voted to make the WASPs eligible for veterans' benefits, even though they were not members of the military in 1977. The surviving pilots are being honored at the ceremony today on Capitol Hill. And in the weather for tonight, mostly clear with some additional cloudiness over southern Maine late at night. Lows 5 to 11 degrees above in the far north with around 30 degrees in the south. And tomorrow will be mostly sunny in the south, becoming partly sunny in the north. Highs in the upper 30s north to the upper 40s south. And we'll have more on the weather coming up later in the program. For MPBN News, I'm Frank Farrell.
This is Maine Things Considered. I'm Josie Huang.
And I'm Ann Mostu. 1 week after legislative Democrats unveiled their $99 million jobs bond package, Governor John Baldacci advanced his own bond package that he says is $20 million leaner, but will be equally effective at putting thousands of Mainers back to work. About $60 million in the governor's plan is directed toward highway, port, and rail projects, including $17 million to preserve 240 miles of rail lines in northern Maine's Aroostook County. A.J. Higgins has more.
The tens of millions of dollars that Governor John Baldacci wants to borrow is an investment that he says Maine taxpayers can't afford to ignore.
This is not a long laundry list of ideas, but instead it's focused on investments to build Maine's economic capacity into the future while creating jobs today.
Baldacci's $79 million bond package, leaner than the $99 million plan offered last week by majority Democrats in the legislature, leans heavily on transportation projects ranging from $28 million for highway reconstruction to create an estimated 750 jobs to $17 million to preserve the Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic Railway that he says is a lifeline for as many as 1,000 heavy industry jobs in northern Maine. The governor says his jobs bond will offer real relief to workers in Maine, even as the State Department of Labor reported that unemployment ticked upward slightly in January to 8.2%. That compares to 7.3% only a year ago.
Today I'm proposing a job creation investment package that will put Mainers back to work. A targeted investment package that puts people to work immediately, combined with a balanced budget, is the right prescription for economic growth. Today, I'm presenting the details of my proposal to put people back to work. The plan focuses heavily on transportation, including roads, rails, and ports, and has been developed with an eye towards projects that will create jobs within 12 months.
Like all bond packages, the governor's recommendations and those of majority Democrats will be weighed by the full legislature, which can only send them on to Maine voters with two-thirds approval in the House and Senate. Republicans are already signaling some concern about the size of both packages in the current economy, arguing that no one can borrow their way into prosperity. Baldacci sees it differently.
I know that some people are concerned about borrowing, but we can't sit around and wait and hope for the economy to improve. We've got to be doing our part, and these projects are sorely needed and will put people back to work, make our roads, make our drinking water, make our community safer and more economically vibrant. We have an opportunity to do that and to make those critical investments. And now is the time to act and to invest in new jobs and to get our people back to work.
I'm very supportive of the idea of a bond package. I think Maine needs it at this point. Certainly the Democrats in the legislature see that. The governor sees that. I'm very hopeful we can pull something together.
House Majority Leader John Piotti, a unity Democrat, says he hopes both parties can unite around a borrowing proposal that helps more Mainers get back into the workforce. But Republicans like Senate Minority Leader Kevin Ray of Perry remain cautious.
But I think there's still significant concern among Republicans about our ability to do any level of borrowing and remaining fiscally responsible. So we're going to have to take a look at it, go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and balance it.
Our concern is Maine taxpayers are drowning in a mountain of taxpayer-supported debt already.
Taryn Bragdon, chief executive officer of the conservative think tank known as the Maine Heritage Policy Center, knows no bond package can go to the voters without the support of some GOP lawmakers, and he wants them to take a longer view of what they're being asked to approve.
We've seen an increase in the obligation that Maine taxpayers are on the hook for of 32%. From 2006 through the end of last year. So adding on top of that just means we're burdening current and future taxpayers with this incredible obligation at a time that our economy is stagnant and we're struggling to get people back to work.
Baldacci says his bond proposal is no greater than 5 to 6% of the state's overall revenue to debt profile and well below the national average with respect to debt per capita ratings. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
When it comes to the 2010 census, Maine has a lot at stake. It's ranked eighth for the amount of federal money it gets per person based on its census numbers. That's according to a new report from the Brookings Institution, a policy research group.
You're getting close to $500 more per person than the rest of the country.
Brookings fellow Andrew Reamer says the federal government spends more than $1,900 per Mainer, compared to the national average of about $1,400 per person. Reamer says that part of that has to do with the fact that Maine is rural with a small population, so more money per person is spent on roads and bridges.
You're getting more money per capita for transportation because you have a lot of open spaces to cover and not a lot of people.
But nationally, what's drawing down the most federal funds by far is Medicaid. Known in Maine as MaineCare, the program provides health insurance to low-income people. The federal government matches state Medicaid dollars, and because the census shows that Mainers have a lower-than-average income, Maine gets a higher federal match.
Maine gets 63 cents back on the dollar. The way Medicaid works is that the richer the state, the lower the reimbursement. So there are a lot of states who only get 50 cents back on the dollar. Maryland, for instance, or Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Hampshire gets 50 cents back on the dollar.
There's another reason Maine gets more federal funds per capita. MaineCare has broader eligibility rules than programs in other states. About a fifth of Maine's population, or 220,000 people, rely on MaineCare. Trish Riley is health policy director under Governor John Baldacci.
We've used Medicaid effectively to help cover the uninsured. It's one of the reasons we have one of the lowest rates of uninsured in the country. It's for the total population, it's 9.6%, and I think we rank sixth among the states.
In some states, you have to live at the poverty line to qualify for Medicaid. But in Maine, parents living at twice the poverty level, about $44,000 for a household of four, can receive MaineCare. Riley points out that Maine also has a large elderly population that receives federal health insurance through Medicare, but are poor enough to also qualify for MaineCare. They also help to draw down federal dollars.
Because of the age of Maine, there's a significant expenditure here for long-term care and home care for the elderly, because the Medicare program does not pay for long-term care for nursing homes, but the Medicaid program does.
Other states with expansive Medicaid programs are also in the top 10 when it comes to receiving federal assistance, such as Vermont and New York. Now, state officials are encouraging Mainers to respond to the census because they say it will help Maine get its fair share of federal funds. They say it will also help determine where in the state the money is most needed. Amanda Rector is a senior economist in the state planning office and a liaison to the U.S. Census Bureau.
The key element is that the decennial census tells us how many people there are in the state and where they are in the state. So we need to know that to figure out where the funding needs to go, which communities have higher populations of the elderly.
Maine's response rate to the 2000 census was 61%, compared to the national average of 67%. The Brookings report indicates Maine should try to boost that rate. It projects that for every Mainer counted, the state will be able to add another $1,300 to its federal income.
If you've ever written a letter or emailed an elected official to share a personal opinion or anecdote about an issue, you may not realize that correspondence is public record. Virtually anyone can obtain a copy under Maine's Freedom of Access laws. Democratic Representative Don Hill of York has introduced a bill to exempt constituents' personal information because she says she and other lawmakers want to protect constituents and themselves when emails contain very private information.
I, too, have been looking at emails and thinking, oh, my word, I'm not sure if people realize what they're saying is part of the public record here and that they should be trying to maybe reach me by telephone with some of their private matters.
During a hearing this week before the Judiciary Committee, legislators gave some examples of the kinds of information they receive. Constituents might attach personal medical information to a complaint they make about MaineCare, or they'll write seeking financial help and provide details about their own bank accounts.
We need to have clear policies for both the House and the Senate how to handle their emails. I would much rather be in the position that if I were challenged from either side for privacy or for public records, where I stood and how to handle it, and that there was a standard for all of us to utilize.
Hill was the only person who testified in favor of the bill, which not only exempts from public record any personal communication from a constituent to an elected official, but also exempts responses from the elected official.
I believe this bill and the amendment that we just received are far too vague.
Chris Cinquemani is spokesman for the Maine Heritage Policy Center, a conservative government watchdog organization.
For example, what is personal information? What is private information? There are examples such as medical information, information about financial status. Prior to that, it says this amendment is not limited to those restrictions. Well, what is the next step?
Hill acknowledges that the bill is vague and says she is trying to correct it with an amendment.
My thought was, at a minimum, that maybe we have to have a notice requirement on the websites for government where people pull up, have some information, and email to someone.
Of the four people who testified in opposition to the bill, three were members of the press, who say they are concerned not about accessing constituents' personal information, but about protecting their ability to monitor government transparency.
While the purpose of this proposed legislation may be well-intended as drafted, it has serious consequences that could severely undermine the confidence of Maine citizens that their government is operating in the open and in their interest.
Mal Leary is president of the Maine Freedom of Information Coalition and a State House journalist.
I think we all know where this stemmed from. Last summer, there was a number of FOIA requests to the presiding officers dealing with the Tabor issue, and in the course of that, some information got out there that the presiding officers were very upset about because it was in this personal nature, but there was nothing to say that they could protect that. So I understand fully where this is coming from, but as I've told folks who've worked on this, the way this is drafted just doesn't do it. It goes way too far.
We lose the ability to watch what the elected officials do.
Judy Meyer is managing editor of the Sun Journal and vice president of the Maine Freedom of Information Coalition.
We lose that level of accountability from the public eye to see how elected officials might respond to one constituent over some concern in some area versus some other constituent in some other concern in some other area. And I'm not suggesting there would be anything anybody would intentionally do anything wrong, but the accountability of having all public business done in the public eye is really vital.
Opponents say they're afraid the proposed measure would create a loophole that would allow elected officials and their lawyers to decide what emails are confidential, which in turn could invite abuse. At the end of the hearing, the Judiciary Committee changed the bill to a resolve and referred it to the state's Right to Know Advisory Commission, on which both Mal Leary and Judy Meyer serve. The commission was given a deadline of February 15, 2011, to draft a report, and then the Judiciary Committee may craft legislation. In the interest of full disclosure, Mal Leary is a contributor to Maine Things Considered, and MPBN State House reporter A.J. Higgins sits on the Right to Know Advisory Commission.
A Midcoast theater group is about to begin a three-week tour to celebrate the work of poet and playwright Edna St. Vincent Millay. Millay, the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for poetry, was born in Rockland in 1892 and later moved to Camden, where she wrote some of her first important poems. And that's where the Everyman Repertory Theater will hold the first of a series of staged readings of Millay's play, Conversations at Midnight, this Friday. Keith Shortall stopped by a rehearsal of the show this week and has this preview.
There's a dark story behind the writing of Conversation at Midnight, which Millay first completed in 1936. She had only one copy of the manuscript and took it with her on a vacation trip to Florida. The hotel caught fire, and the manuscript was destroyed. Several months later, as she tried to recreate the script from memory, Millay had a serious car accident that caused severe nerve damage in her back and right arm, from which she never fully recovered. But the play won critical acclaim for Millay and is held up as an example of the author's poetic versatility.
I've got an aunt who's neither worse nor better than other people's aunts. She has her ways, disbuds her dahlias, occasionally writes a letter to the Times. She's going to die one of these days, and I'm her only heir. And if I hustle and call on her, kiss her hand, drink up her drinks,
John said.
Well, she's so rich, she doesn't rustle when she comes into her room. You know, she chinks.
Yeah, I mean, she uses everything from the sonnet, from highly formalized poetic forms down to Ogden Nash impersonations.
Paul Hodgson is artistic director of the Everyman Repertory Theater and one of the seven actors gathered in the basement of the Church of Christ Congregational in Camden, each in black formal attire. The characters include a priest, an advertising executive, and a communist poet. The play, says Hodgson, takes the form of a conversational poem, which conjures up an after-dinner discussion about love and war, politics and religion.
And, you know, some of it is extremely funny and some of it is really beautiful verse. Absolutely. I mean, it's not verse, it's poetry, in fact.
It's just not funny enough. It's not good enough a joke. Drinking your health and thinking, I hope you choke.
Incredulous God! Could I impersonate John, do you think?
Pygmalion screamed.
Look at him, sitting there on his arse like a belted earl, and not enough in his 8-year-old pockets to buy us a drink. See here, my boy, You never had no aunt. You only dreamed you had an aunt. It was just a dream you had. Get me?
Now sometimes it works like a normal play, so you have a character name and then a set of dialogue following. And sometimes you have the action is basically narrated, so there are people saying said Merton and said Pygmalion, and that happens every now and then through the play, depending on how she feels and how in fact the meter dictates.
I think I'll play some Bach, if you can stand my noise. Go right on talking, please.
And spread over the pedals of the concert grand, Ricardo could not play, but kept in tune always and hoped someone might call who could, his broad black boots, twitched up his gown, and soon built peace from felt, wire, ivory, and wood.
This certainly speaks to some of her amazing writing.
Everyman actor David Troop, who plays John, the portrait painter, says that at one point in the play, Anselmo the priest, played by Jennifer Hodgson, decides to remove herself from the conversation.
Being that people have not been taking to her explanations of the necessity of faith and the beauty of God. She then goes to play Bach and in essence recreates some of the beauty that she is talking about through her poetry within the actual music.
Nobody talked, although it seemed that some preferred to talk, and they were cowed into this hush. Ricardo not. He cared not whence might come this beauty. So it came.
Troop and Hodgson say they hope the tour of staged readings will shine a light on the work of a poet whose origins are firmly planted in Midcoast Maine.
She grew up in Rockland. She went to high school in Camden and, of course, became the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. And this, we hope through this active reading of her poetry will help people familiarize themselves with her work while at the same time getting a chance to meet seven characters that she created through her poems.
I should add that we are actually standing recording this interview in the church that her family attended and she went to Sunday school in.
In fact, the venues that you've chosen to perform are connected to her in some way.
That's right, yeah. And we weren't able to perform at the Whitehall Inn in Camden, which is where she was discovered reading her poem Renaissance, because it's closed and it's winter. But hopefully this summer we'll be able to put that to rights. But yeah, we chose the church because it was her church and she came here. We chose the Camden Public Library and the reading room there because I'm sure that she read poems in there and borrowed books from that library as well. We're doing it in Rockland because, again, she was born in Rockland before she moved to... She lived in Camden, Rockport, and Hope, as well as Rockland. So we've tried to spread it around to her roots in Maine.
Now stand right up and tell it to the jury. Quick, before they all go mad.
I have got an aunt.
The Everyman Repertory Theater production of Edna St. Vincent Millay's Conversation at Midnight opens at the First Church of Christ Congregational in Camden this Friday at 7, and will move Sunday to the Farnsworth Art Museum Auditorium at 2 p.m. For a complete list of dates and times of the full March tour, go to mpbn.net and click on this story. For MPBN News, I'm Keith Shortall.
Who knows? I might get fond of the poor old soul, trot her around to theaters, and on a Sunday trot her to church. Love God, too, swallow it whole. But there's something disingenuous, not quite hearty, in taking up with God or your aunt when you're an interested party.
It's 2 minutes before 6. Time to check the weather forecast with meteorologist Max Reisman.
Clear skies stay in place tonight as high pressure remains in control of the northeast. Winds will remain nearly calm tonight. This, in combination with the clear skies and dry air mass, allows for a chilly night across the Pine Tree State. This will be especially true from Greenville northward, where overnight lows dip into the teens. Warmer, with low to mid-20s in southern Maine. A high, thin overcast moves into the southern third of Maine tomorrow, with partly cloudy skies persisting in northern Maine. Highs range from the upper 30s to mid-40s north, with mid to upper 40s through southern Maine. Becoming mostly cloudy with a chance of a rain or snow shower from Bangor southward tomorrow night. Partly cloudy north. Lows in the teens through Aroostook County, with mid-20s to low 30s elsewhere. Clouds will thin out slightly on Friday as drier air edges southward. Highs Friday in the 40s. The weekend forecast contains the threat for rain and wind through southern Maine Saturday night into Sunday, with scattered clouds and showers north. Highs over the weekend in the mid-40s. For the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm meteorologist Max Reisman.
That's Maine Things Considered for this Wednesday. We had production help from Barbara Caridi and Susan Sharon. I'm Josie Huang.
And I'm Ann Mostu. Thanks for listening.